Hi everyone, Benjamin here. Welcome to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. And today, I'm in Liverpool. I'm actually standing in the Albert Dock, which is quite beautiful, surrounded by boats. I can see the Liver building to my left here just poking out. Just behind me here is the Tate, and behind that is the River Mersey. But why am I here? Well, listeners, this week it's been the Microbiology Society's annual conference 2016. And it's been going on for 4 days now. We've had over 1,400 delegates, exhibitors and staff here, and there's been a huge amount of amazing science talks. From bacteria, to fungi, to viruses, you name it, we've had something on it. Now, Anand and I got to speak to just a few of these researchers about their work. Later in today's show, you'll hear me talking to Professor George Weinstock, who was there at the start of the microbial genomics revolution. You'll also hear a short extract from me doing an on-stage interview with our prize medal winner, Professor Philippe Sansonetti, from the Pasteur Institute in France. First, though, Anand spoke to Dr. Lucy Gilbert from the James Hutton Institute about her work on how environmental changes will impact on ticks and disease risk.
So tell me a bit more about ticks and the kind of diseases that they spread.
Yeah, so ticks are an arthropod and they're related to spiders. They're not insects, they're acari. The main type of tick we have in the UK is Ixodes ricinus. We actually have a lot of different species of ticks, but Ixodes ricinus is the really common one. It's a generalist that will suck the blood of any animal, any terrestrial mammal or bird in the UK, including us and our dogs, sheep, horses, deer, mice, everything. The most common pathogen that Ixodes ricinus transmits is Borrelia, which is the agent causing Lyme disease. And that's increasing in the UK at the moment. But there are other viruses as well as bacteria that these ticks transmit, such as Laupingill virus, which can harm sheep and red grouse in the upland areas of the UK.
And so in your talk just now, where you were focusing on Lyme disease in particular, so tell me a bit more about Lyme disease and, you know, how serious of a condition it is and what it's caused by.
Well, it's caused by a spirochete bacteria called Borrelia. It's actually related to syphilis, which means that it's a very slow reproducing bacteria in the body. So it's quite difficult to treat, and the symptoms can develop quite slowly because it's not suddenly reproducing really rapidly like normal bacteria. So the tick will bite you, inject the Borrelia bacteria, and it will then very slowly start to reproduce. Apparently, most people will, their immune system can just zap the bacteria successfully and you'll never know you had it. But some people do get symptoms. Some people get what's called an erythema migrans rash, which is a distinctive bullseye rash, a little dot with a circle around it. And that circle can be tiny or it can be massive. And we don't know what proportion of people get that rash. Maybe 60 or 80% of people will get that. If they're lucky, because that's absolutely diagnostic. So if you have that, you have Lyme disease. Sometimes that can just go away on its own and you'll be fine, but it's really recommended to get antibiotics from the GP to cure that. And occasionally the antibiotics don't do the job, or your own immune system will not shut down once the infection's gone and it'll start self-harming your body. So you can get a very small number, a very, very unfortunate people do get chronic Lyme disease. And that can create all sorts of cardiac problems or neurological problems, joint pains, and it can be very severe indeed. And it's really, really nasty and extremely difficult to treat.
So tell me a bit more about the kind of aspects of environmental change that we can expect to really impact the distribution of tick populations in the UK.
Well, in my talk, I highlighted three main changes that will impact on ticks and Lyme disease. The first, of course, is climate warming. As the climate warms, the ticks can be more active because, like all arthropods, their activity is limited by cold temperatures. So the warmer it is, the more active they can be. So their active season will spread throughout the year more. So at the moment, in Scotland, for example, they're probably active between, say, April and May and October-ish. But with climate warming, we will expect that to increase by at least 1 or 2 months. There's also woodland expansion. So at the moment, one of the biggest land use changes in the UK and Europe actually is woodland expansion. And the reason for that is for biodiversity, for carbon sequestration, for recreational purposes, for timber production, all good things. But the problem with woodlands is that a lot of animals like woodlands. So the animals carry ticks, and a lot of the animals will transmit Lyme disease. So one of the things I'm looking at is where the woodland expansion will increase ticks and how it will change our risk of getting Lyme disease. What I have found is that if those woodlands are fenced to exclude deer completely, the risk of Lyme disease should be a lot less, because deer, although they don't transmit the disease, they carry a lot of ticks. So a lot of ticks means we get bitten more. So deer management can really help, actually, because deer basically drive tick numbers, although they don't drive the disease, but they drive tick numbers. So control the deer and you'll control the ticks, and hopefully there'll be less risk, although that needs a lot more research.
What kind of experiments have you been running kind of in the lab and out in the field to try and model and estimate how changes in climate might affect tick populations?
Well, first of all, we wanted to know how climate change might affect tick activity. So will they be more active as the climate warms? So we took ticks into the lab and we exposed them to different temperatures, basically warming a climate through just a few weeks rather than decades. And we found a really dramatic effect that as you increase the temperature from 6 degrees up to about 15 degrees, the proportion of ticks that are active goes from about 10% to 90%. So basically, as the climate warms, we must expect the ticks to be more active. If they're not active, they're at no risk to us because they're asleep and developing or hiding. If they're active, that means that they're actually looking for a host like us to feed on.
Kind of moving on from experiments in the lab, what do we know about how that translates into the real world?
So to look at how that translates to the real world, we thought we would try to look at a sort of climate warming proxy and how tick numbers change in that. And one good way of getting a proxy for climate change is using altitude. So at the top of a mountain, it's a very cold climate. At the bottom, it's a warmer climate. So if if climate change projections predict that our climate will be 3 degrees warmer by 2080, what we can do is walk down a mountain from 800 metres high down to 400 metres high, and that should replicate the same sort of climate change. So we did this in the Cairngorm Mountains in the Highlands of Scotland, and we found a dramatic increase in ticks once we had walked down the hill below about 550 metres. Above 550 metres, there were almost no ticks at all. Below 550 metres, suddenly you got more and more ticks, and at the bottom of the glens, there were a lot of ticks. So from that, we expect that as the climate warms, there will be more ticks, but also there'll be more ticks at the top of the mountains.
And so you actually carried out this field work yourself. Kind of tell me a bit more about what that was like, kind of trudging up the highlands looking for ticks.
It was myself and some very trusty assistants. We had a French student that year helping out as well, who wasn't used to cold weather. And we had to walk up and down these big Cairngorm mountains. We dragged a blanket, 1 by 1 meter square of blanket, and the ticks attached to the blanket, so you can then count the ticks on the blanket. And it was often cold and wet and windy on top of the mountains, and the student was really, really good at just suffering and staying cheerful. But it was a great fun project. It was very tough, obviously, but it was worth it because we got great results.
And so I guess the next question is, in terms of the bigger picture, so you've managed to model these kind of three effects, these three factors, and look at how they might affect both tick distribution, but also Lyme disease risk. So where do we kind of sit now? What's kind of next for you and your research group, but also how does this kind of help us to maybe be better informed about how we can prevent the disease from increasing in transmission as climate change and these other factors kind of continue?
So we've done some sort of big modelling exercises that have attempted to predict the tick abundance over Scotland, the whole of Scotland, under the current climate and in future climate, and including with future woodland expansion. And those models have now been produced, and we now have some quite nice sort of risk maps produced showing the current maps of where the ticks are common or rare, and then the future maps of where the ticks will be common or rare, and they show that the ticks will become more common and go up the hills a bit more, move north. We've also just beginning to try to do the same for Lyme disease risk. We're right at the beginning of that, but we do have some preliminary risk maps for Lyme disease in Scotland now and with future climate change. And again, the climate change predictions, predictive maps do predict that Lyme disease will become more common and again move up the mountains a bit more. We really just need a lot more data to validate these models, because they might be completely wrong. We don't know, because we're looking into the future. And we also need better data to actually parameterize the models for the current climate.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Lucy.
All right. Thanks very much.
That was Lucy Gilbert there, talking with Anand. Next up is our prize medal winner, Professor Philippe Santinetti from the Pasteur Institute. Now, the Society's prize medal is awarded annually to a global leader whose work has had a far-reaching impact on microbiology. Philippe is world-renowned for his work on the Shigella pathogen. I had the absolute pleasure of getting to interview him in front of a live audience, and I started by asking him to describe a key experiment from his career.
Well, there are a few, but I mean, if I have to take one, I think it goes back to the mid-80s when I started to do this so-called cellular microbiology. I mean, I was looking for, you know, phenotypes of microbial interaction with host cells, and actin was the big thing at the moment. So we were looking at actin polymerization as the bacterium was entering into the cell. And one day I got mixed up in the timing of the experiments, and when I started to stain my cells, the bacteria were already inside. They were not entering anymore. And I started to see these nice comets that were tracking the bacterium, like a bacterium where the bacteria were moving inside the cells, and they had this sort of actin, you know, comet, as we called it at the time, following or pushing or whatever it was at the time. And these are great moments, because suddenly you find something totally unexpected and you start to sort of, you know, basically, is this fitting in the model?
Yeah.
What could it be? What could it not be? It was really, really great. And so this was the beginning of the story about the, you know, actin-based motility of bacteria and cell-to-cell spread. And I submitted the paper to PNAS. The reviews came back, and the first review, which was really a bad start, said, "This is the most beautiful artifact I've ever seen in cell biology." So you could take it as a compliment, but at the time I didn't have this sense of humor. I didn't really take it as a compliment. And so François Jacob was actually submitting the paper, and so he called me and he said, "Yo, this is an artifact." "No, it's not an artifact. I mean, I've seen it. We've done it several times now." And we started to talk, and finally, he didn't mention that anymore, and I wanted to know if he accepted or not, except to communicate the paper to PNAS. So, I was free. And then the conversation ended, and he had not said anything, so I said, you know, was on the door leaving, and I said, you know, are you communicating the paper? He looked at me, and he said, "Of course, you said it's not an artifact."
So, nice. Okay. So I think what I'm taking from that is sometimes it's best to forget to do your experiments on time.
Absolutely. That's just serendipity.
Professor Philippe Santinetti there, and you can hear a fuller version of our interview in a later podcast. Finally this month, I spoke with Professor George Weinstock. Now, George was there at the start of the microbial genome sequencing revolution. I asked him what it was like at the time and what he thought these techniques would achieve.
Well, the genome that we focused on at the beginning, and we, it's myself and also Dr. Steve Norris, this is when I was at the University of Texas Medical School in Houston, we were interested in the genome of an organism called Treponema pallidum. Now, T. pallidum is the bacterium that causes syphilis, and so it's been known for a long time. It's a very famous organism. It's a very important disease. And of all of the major pathogens, T. pallidum is the only one that can't be cultured in the laboratory. It has to be grown in rabbit testes. So here's this terribly important pathogen, this important and fascinating disease, and we don't have a prayer of really understanding the bacterium that's doing it, because we always have to grow it in rabbit testes. So we put in a grant, Steve and I, to the NIH, probably 1990 or something, right around the time when the Human Genome Project was just starting to come into focus, let's say. And we said, the only way you're ever going to understand this bacterium is to sequence its genome. And this was sort of heresy, a radical concept in those days. And we had just shown that it had a genome of 1 million bases, which may sound like a lot, but actually it's nothing in the world of genomes. It's nothing. So the NIH agreed, fortunately, and they said, we'd like you to do a few years of preliminary work on it, and then we'll put in another grant, and that'll be the grant where you can push it over the finish line and sequence it. And in those days, I mean, nowadays you sequence thousands of genomes in a project. You sequence metagenomes, all of the organisms in the community that's in your gut, and that's literally hundreds of different taxa. And you just do that in a night. And in those days, to do this one little genome of a bacterium was going to be a 5 to 10 year project. And that's what you were up against in the beginning. We didn't have the right kind of sequencing machines, and nobody really had anything. And around the time that we had finished our initial preliminary studies, which amounted to making very detailed maps of the chromosome, things like that, so that we could sequence it in bits, a new organization called TIGER, which stands for the Institute for Genome Research, had just been founded, and they had sequenced the bacterium Haemophilus influenzae. And that was really the first bacterial genome that had sequenced. And they had been unable to get NIH funding for that project. And they were desperate to, you know, find a project they could do. And so we hooked up with them, and we got the renewal of our grant to do the sequencing. And we paired up with TIGER and sequenced the genome of Treponema pallidum. But even then, we couldn't put it all back together and do the complete analysis of it for another few years, because we were still inventing many of the tools that were necessary for doing it at that time. So that was the beginning of it. That was really just thinking of things that you had to do. It was the only way you could do it, even though you didn't have anywhere near the means to do it at the time.
So in classic compare and contrast then, could you guys see the leaps forward we've made? And what can we do now that we couldn't do at the time? And what sort of difference has it made?
I would say that if we look back now on that project with the things that have passed in the 15 years or so, 20 years or so since we completed it, you just couldn't imagine it. It's like the Wright brothers trying to get a plane off the ground and the moonshot program going to the moon and coming back multiple times. It's just completely off the charts now compared to what it is. For example, we resequenced Treponema pallidum many times now using different sequencing methods as they came available. It's sort of like a week-long project now. It cost $500,000 the first time. Now we do it for a couple of $100s. We have much more accurate sequences now. We can go back and correct all the mistakes we made in that first lovingly performed sequence. It's just very, very different. And over those years, the sequencing technology has, for us, I would say every year and a half to 2 years, we can sequence 10 times more than we could at the beginning of that period, so that like right now, I know that the amount of sequencing that we can do is only going to be 10% or so of what I can do in 2 years. And it seems like I'm doing a daunting amount of sequencing now, but I'll look back on it in a few years and just kind of chuckle. And that's kind of what it's like to look back on that first Treponema pallidum project. But for us, it was just a game changer. It allowed us to think through not just the sequencing part, but when you have a sequence, how do you predict the genes? And then when you've predicted the genes, how do you try to figure out what the function of the genes is? How do you put them together into pathways so you know the metabolism of the organism? This is a pathogen. How can you find the genes that allows it to do what it does inside the host? All of that stuff was really new, to be able to do it on a genome-wide, on a whole system-wide level. And so it was a terribly important project for us.
I know that you're also heavily involved in the Human Microbiome Project as well. In terms of microbiome research, and you hear it advertised everywhere now, you know, for good or bad, what do you think maybe is the singularity, to use the technologist's term? What's the one piece of information we need for microbiome research to make a big difference, do you think?
Well, microbiome research starts out far more complicated because it's built on the idea that you have to analyze communities of different bacteria that are in different parts of the body in order to figure out what's going on. So right off the bat, you've gone to a much more complex project than simply sequencing one bacteria was in the old days. Having said that, our tools are just so much more powerful, our costs are so much lower, and our thinking about how to approach this is so much more sophisticated that if we wanted to zoom in on any one bacteria in the community in your gut, just from microbiome type of analysis, we could do that. But we know we have to actually zoom in on hundreds of them and follow them in parallel to begin to make sense out of it. So from the genomics point of view, that's the difference in scope of the project. In terms of ultimate deliverables, you know, one really wants to think that by looking at the microbial communities that are all around your body, and they're all different in different parts of your body, that you're not only going to be able to sort of see what your status is, just like when you take your blood pressure or your temperature or things like that, but you'll also be able to diagnose when things are going off in some part of the body. And you also expect to be able to provide new kinds of therapeutics that are not toxic to the body, but really have to do with manipulating the microbes and reestablishing a community that is more balanced and healthy than one that's gotten out of whack. And that just requires good old microbiology, just pulling all those individual organisms out of there, having libraries of them that you can then add back, but being able to do it rationally, being able to understand which are the key ones that are either under or overrepresented and how to manipulate them. So that's really the ultimate deliverable of the microbiome.
So experiment is truth remains the case today then?
There's just one good old time religion, and that's what we always reduce all of our science down to.
So I understand in your talk, you're interested in the human microbiome for maybe a particular group of humans. Is there anything you can talk about that?
Oh, so I'm happy to talk about that. We're interested in trying to figure out what's the golden microbiome. What's the microbiome that we would all like in us? And so we've picked as an example of that. Not everybody may agree with this, but there it is anyway. We want to figure out what's the microbiome that athletes have so that we can all be fit and lean and motivated and dedicated and high energy and have all of the attributes that it takes to be a really excellent athlete. So we're studying the gut microbiome and the salivary microbiome too of people who do downhill bike racing every week. So they're very fit, they're very courageous. If you've ever seen people doing downhill bike racing, that's not like the Tour de France. They're going cross country, they're dodging trees, they're dodging rocks, they're doing all kinds of things. They're very brave people, and they go fast, and they're very fit. So when we look at their microbiome, lo and behold, there are certain bacteria that they have much more of than the typical healthy adult in their same age group, or even somebody who's like a weekend warrior and will ride their bike on the weekends too, but is not that professional level. One of the bacteria that's particularly interesting is an archaebacteria called Methanobrevibacter smithii, which has, archaebacteria have a different kind of metabolism than the other bacteria do. They're one of the three kingdoms of life on the earth. There's eukaryotes, there's bacteria, and there's archaebacteria. And the bacteria, who are most of the ones that we're familiar with in our gut, the E. coli's and the ones like that, do a metabolism, and generally there's a collection of end products that come out of metabolism of bacteria. Archaebacteria have a different metabolism, and they can take as food the end products of metabolism from other bacteria, things like hydrogen gas and CO2 and acetate and the other kinds of molecules that are excreted. And so they can live on those. They can convert them into nutrients. They can get energy from them. So one speculates that an athlete, one of the things that makes an athlete more energetic and fit than us is they have more of this M. smithii, so they can get an extra bounce out of the food that gets eaten. Plus, they can kind of clean up the environment in the gut so that the other bacteria can do even more efficient metabolism. So that's just the hypothesis that's come jumping out at us, but it's sort of like great moments in microbiome research when you do a pilot project and something hits you over the head that's really interesting.
That was George Weinstock there. That's it for this special on-location edition of the podcast. It's been a great conference, and thank you so much to everyone who came to talk to Anand and I. But if you couldn't be here, we've got loads of stories from the conference on our website, which is microbiologysociety.org. We've got a ton of stuff on our blog. If you search for the Microbe Post, you should be able to find that. And even more stuff on our Twitter feed, at microbiosoc. If you look for the hashtag microbio16, you can follow what everyone had to say. I've been Benjamin Thompson. I'm off to sleep now for about 18 hours, I think. Our show was produced and edited, as always, by Anand Jagatia. We're back next month. See you then.